Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. And I got just an amazing guest here with us today. And I want to tell you a little story. In 1977, I was down in Greenwich Village one week, and I grew up in New York City, and I was shopping in the used record stores, which was the joy of my life at the time. I would live to go down into the city and buy used music because I could afford it, you know, and I can buy a bunch of records for, you know, 10 or 20 records for $5 sometimes. Anyway, I was 14 and I was looking to learn more about music and the history of the music I was listening to, and learn about new music as well. So I'm in one of these stores, maybe Second Coming Records or Bleecker Street, Bleecker Bob's, and I stumble across this album with a double album fold over cover, which I was always attracted to because they were cooler and there's more to look at, you know, more to enjoy, more to talk about. And the album's called Alone Together. It was by Dave Mason, who I knew from Traffic. And I actually still have this album sitting right here in front of me, in spite of having cleaned up hundreds of vinyl records I got rid of. This one was not going anywhere. Anyway, it's an amazing album, and we'll talk about some of the songs in it today. But then let's fast forward to February 2015, just a couple of years ago. I was with my older son, Nick. He was 25, and we went to the Capitol Theater out in Clearwater, and we went to see Dave Mason. And Dave was playing a few of the songs off this album, of course. Now, I have this saying, and you might have heard it before. I always say you can't connect the dots moving forward, which is really appropriate, because if you told 14-year-old me back in 1977, hey, Craig, you're going to be having a conversation with Dave Mason one day, I would have looked at you like you were crazy. Well, today, welcome the one and only Dave Mason to the show. I really appreciate your time. Dave's sitting and enjoying himself in Maui.
Yep.
So thanks very much, man.
You're welcome.
Hey, you were born not long after World War II ended, and I was curious what England was like growing up in that post-war period and how this impacted your youth and your viewpoint of life and maybe even your music.
Well, I don't know. It's just, you know, your environment and where you – and whatever you grow up in, I guess it is what it is. It's not really, it's not anything I really thought about, to be honest with you. I mean, I remember still, you know, bombed out parts of cities and stuff that were still there. I mean, I was born in May 1946, so basically just a year after the end of the Second World War. But I mean, I'm more, you know, it's more to do with, you know, my parents than anything. I mean, my father was born in 1894.
Wow. So he, yeah.
And my father was in the 1914-18 war, and my half brother was driving tanks in North Africa in the Second World War. So, he grew up with a lot of that. With all that, I grew up with a lot of footage and viewing of stuff on TV of that, a lot of the concentration camps,
wow,
all that stuff. And then, of course, you know, Saturday here in Hawaii, we had a missile alert.
Yeah, that's right. We heard all about that.
Okay. So for half an hour, everybody was under the impression that there was a missile coming. Probably if it was, it would be going to Pearl Harbor anyway. So, you know, everybody freaked. But, you know, and my wife, Winifred, I mean, who was I was actually still asleep, so he didn't bother me, but she was at yoga and everybody was just wigged out. I said, now you understand how most of my childhood, more affected by the, probably by the Cold War and the possibility of a nuclear Holocaust at any moment, really, than whatever happened prior to. So, you know, I grew up under all that stuff.
Interesting. So I guess because you didn't have that before and after framework, it really wasn't, like you said, it was what it was. It was nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It is what it is. And so you just, you know, you, there's other things going on in your life when you're a kid. Everything is, you know, everything is, you know, it's like when you're, it's like when you're young, you know, the weird part about life is when you're young, things seem to take forever and you can't wait to grow up or get older or do things that adults can do, and days sort of stretch out, and as you get older time just seems to get compressed and goes by faster, you know. But I think it's more to do with the fact when you're a kid, you know, everything moment, there are more moments and those moments seem to stretch. And when you get older, you sort of, you know, you have your patterns, you have your, what your likes and your dislikes are. And so I think that's a lot to do with how time seems to get compressed when you get older.
Yeah, definitely. How did you initially hook up with Steve Winwood and Jim Capaldi to form Traffic?
Well, I'm from Worcester, England, which is in the heartland of England. If anybody wants to figure out where it is, it's 12 miles from the Welsh border, mm-hmm. 25 miles from Stratford-on-Avon, and 35 miles from Birmingham, which is where the Steve Winwood and the Spencer Davis group hailed from. And Jim and I were, you know, we were in two or three bands together when we started, and we'd go play pubs and little clubs and stuff up in Birmingham, and we were big fans, obviously, of the Spencer Davis group, and I think we all kind of first met in a place called the Elbow Room, which was an after-hours sort of private, semi-private club. They'd have music there sometimes, and sort of the early Moody Blues were playing there once when Denny Lane was the lead singer. And I think that's where I'm pretty sure that's where we kind of first all met up. And I guess it just sort of developed into this sort of, you know, friendship of just myself and Jim and Steve and Chris Wood. And we just finished up sort of whenever we could, meeting up or hanging out. And we all had, you know, between the four of us, which is sort of what made Traffic such an interesting group, is that we had, you know, we all had similar tastes in music, and we all, but very diverse. I mean, it was, you know, a combination of pop, blues, jazz, gospel, R&B. And we would, you know, we'd hang out and just play. God, we'd hang out all night listening to music and listening to records, and, you know, and I mean, and that's kind of basically how we sort of started getting together. And then as it went along, Steve, I guess, wanted to branch out and do something new. And so we started talking about putting a band together, the four of us. I mean, we, you know, I sang on three Spencer Davis hits. Sang harmony on Somebody Help Me, and then myself and Jim were the pretty much singing the backgrounds on Give Me Some Loving and I'm a Man.
Interesting.
So, and that's how it started. And then I, in between it all, I went, I was roadie for, I played being a roadie for 3 months with the Spencer Davis Group, which, and then I actually, I had to stand in for Steve one night because he didn't turn up, which was sort of interesting. But so that's how Traffic sort of developed.
And your memory is pretty good. You remember the name of the bar. That was pretty impressive. I don't think most people can remember the name of the bar they went to last month.
Well, well, it was more than just a bar. It was, you know, it was a, like I said, it was a private after hours club. And Don Carlos and Roy was a Jamaican. And Don Carlos, and they had very eclectic music taste too. They were very into music. So yeah, that's kind of how it sort of, you know, it developed.
You left Traffic later on and you moved to the US, and I was curious if you're comfortable talking about it. What made you leave Traffic and what?
I left Traffic actually after the first album.
Hmm.
First of all, and I left because I was just, I left because I was just, you know, I was about, God, I think it was, I don't know, was I 18, 19 years old? I just couldn't deal with the success. It was all too much for me. And I left the band and I did some stuff, in that period of time, I got to know Hendrix. I produced an album for a band called The Family, a music in a doll's house.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of, you know, I wrote sort of more or less half the first album, but they were very, I mean, I wrote the Traffic's first big hit. Not in America's Traffic at the very beginning with the Dear Mr. Fantasy album really was an unknown quantity here in America.
Hmm.
And their first big hit single was the first song I ever wrote called Hole in My Shoe. And the rest of the stuff that I was writing were just very, I mean, I'm from Worcester, England. I'm from basically an upper class family, not wealthy, but certainly we had the best of all the necessities in life. So I had zero street smarts. Okay.
Sure.
and I really hadn't, there wasn't really too much I'd gone through in life other than very early on in life. I was in hospital for a year and a half. I was consciously aware of the fact that if I'm going to write songs, I really need to get some life experience,
oh,
I guess.
Okay.
And part of that leaving was to do with that. And so I left and that was basically it. And I got to know other people. I got to work with other people. And I went away for, went to Greece for about 2 weeks to an island called Hydra, little island off the coast of Athens, where actually Leonard Cohen had a house there. And I so, just on a bag and a little bag and a guitar and very little money. Lived on feta cheese and Nana's bread and Retsina. And I wrote five songs while I was there, basically. One of them was Feeling All Right. And another one was You Can All Join In. And I was in the U.S. for some reason, I don't exactly know, probably just because I just wanted to, you know, come over here. And the band, they were in New York at the record plant, and they were doing the second album, Traffic album, and they only had five tracks. And I was at the studio. I said, well, I got five songs, you know. So it was like, well, great. Okay. Come back in the band? I was like, okay, sure. Why not? Let's, you know. So we cut that, and we cut the second album. And again, my stuff was, you know, I have a pop sensibility when I write.
As far as writing, okay.
You know, it's got to be melodic, and it's got to have a hook. So I have a very pop sensibility when I'm writing something. And so, again, my stuff was picked for the singles. And
presumably because of that pop sensibility.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I consciously wrote that way. I mean, I have a very pragmatic sense of what I do. I mean, it's, you know, as much as people want to, you know, go, well, the art, you know, it's all about the art, you know, and, you know, my answer is, yeah, Art Lieberman, my accountant, is, you know, it's a business. This is also my business. This Sure. is what I do. This is what supports my way of, you know, my life.
Of course.
And my family. So it is a business. And so, you know, a lot of that's tied up in along with what I do. But so the thing is, it just, again, like I'm saying, my stuff always got picked for the singles. That created a problem for the other three.
Because their stuff wasn't being picked up, or they resented you, or
I don't know. Okay. But eventually that became an issue, and the other three decided that what I was doing did not fit in Traffic. So that became the final break.
Okay.
With everything. And my, you know, as I tell people, you know, people talk about the British invasion. And I always say, well, you know, the reality is the British invasion is an American story. Because the reality, I mean, you know, there would be no me. There'd be no Eric Clapton. There'd be no Jeff Beck. There'd be no, you know, whatever band. There'd be none of those British bands if it wasn't for American music. Because all we, you know, everything comes from here. Other than folk music, real folk music or real country music, not the crap they peddle as country music anymore, but real country music, okay, is that's the only thing that has European heritage to it. Otherwise, everything else is just American. All we did was learn from, you know, Eric and the rest of us copped every blues lick that any blues player ever played. And, you know, and so we just rolled it all into, we took it all from here, and we took it and sort of molded it into our own little version of it and sold it back to America. So, and the other part about it is, you know, in growing up is we, in Europe, we didn't have segregated radio. So we didn't have to, you know, we heard it all. And we were very into all the black artists, unlike America, where most white people had no clue what was going on with black music, because it was a segregated situation. So we didn't have that in England. So we grew up with all that. We were, you know.
Interestingly enough, that issue is more like a phenomena that was created in like the late 70s, 80s. Because I was a kid growing up before FM even came on, you'd listen to AM radio, you'd hear funk, you know, Sly and the Family Stones. You'd hear all, you know, Motown. It would be all on the same radio station right next to, you know, the Rolling Stones and Traffic. So I think this is like a phenomenon that started like in the late 70s.
Well, in a way, I mean, we, you know, in doing all that, we, what sort of happened and what is, we turned you back onto your own music, basically.
Yes. Yes, that's 100% accurate. Yes. Yeah, because you filtered it through the channels that can get through on the white stations, quote
right.
unquote. Yeah, right. In a sense, that's pretty interesting. Well, let me ask you this. I appreciate you being so straightforward when you said you couldn't deal with the success. In what way do you mean, as far as you felt duplicitous because you were writing about struggles that you hadn't experienced?
No. I felt personally that. Because the success made people deal with me in a whole different way. I mean, I never got into this to be, quote, a star.
Right.
I got into this to make music, have fun, and make some money. Hmm. That's what I got into this for. And I never got into it to be a star. So I'm just a guy from Worcester that, you know, puts his pants on one leg at a time like anybody else.
Man, I get
it. It just happens to be this is what I do. And it's thankfully it's been successful.
Okay, so the celebrity aspect of what you do just wasn't it was uncomfortable, I guess.
It still is for me.
Yeah, yeah. And I have to tell you, man, everybody listening, Dave's just chilling out on his patio, you know, just like, you know, like the guy who puts his pants on one leg at a time, you know, he looks like my neighbor from across the street or something, you know. Right. Hey, how'd you wind up playing 12 string with Hendrix on All Along the Watchtower?
Well, I got to know Hendrix. I mean, another thing is that, you know, in England, unlike America, America had, you know, you had a number of music centers in America, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, Nashville, Atlanta, Philadelphia. There were a whole number of music centers. In England, everybody finished up in London. Right. Everybody. Because that's where the studios were. That's where you went. And in London, there were a number of, like the Elbow Room where I met Steve, there were a number of private clubs. Blazes, Scotch of St. James, and so on. And when you'd go to Blazes late, you know, around 11 o'clock or something at night, you'd always be somebody, you know, you'd run into, I mean, you could go walk in there, it'd be Lennon and Mick Jagger, Brian Jones, Hendrix. I mean, you name it. It could be anybody in there late at night. There's only a few places to go. So he was sitting near the table by himself and I just sat down and started talking to him. And he was a fan of Traffic's and I was, huge fan of his. And that's how I struck up a relationship with him and spent time hanging out with him. And during that period of time, actually, when I first left, there was some rifts going on with Noel. And I was going to take Noel's place. And Jimmy had asked if I would do that. But we were at a friend of his one afternoon. So we had a friend of Jimmy's had an advanced copy of John Wesley Harding.
Okay.
The Dylan album.
Yep.
And so it's like, oh, well, we got to go, you know, we got to stop by and take a listen to this. And so we went over there and there was some other people there and was just hanging out, playing the album. And I guess something caught his ear with Watchtower. And so I can't remember exactly how long. I think, I don't know, a few days later, we were in Olympic Studios. Myself and Jimmy and Mitchell. And actually, Brian Jones was there. Brian was at the studio because I knew Brian and hung out with him quite a bit. But Brian was very, Brian was not really in any state to be playing anything. He was just there.
Yeah.
And so we laid down the basic track for Watchtower, which was me and on 12 string and Jimmy on had a 6 string acoustic. And we just sort of sat opposite each other on a, and Mitch and laid down the basic track for Watchtower. And that's how I got to play the 12 string on it. And then Jimmy played bass on it and put the electric guitar on there. And there you go. All along the Watchtower.
Just like that. Did you have any sort of premonition at the time regarding what that song, you know, how explosive that would be? And also like what Hendrix, did you have any vision or premonition what influence Hendrix would be on guitar, or just that, you know, holy shit, this guy's going to be like some major deal?
Well, I knew he was going to be a major deal from the first time I ever saw him, which was one, again, in one of those private clubs when Chaz first brought him to London. Mm. He took him around these little clubs, and Jimmy just got up, sat in with these bands, and that's where I first saw him. Was I think in the little place called the Scotch of St. James, I think it was, and he lanky black guy with a big fuzzy Bob Dylan hairdo got up and started playing guitar, and I was like, "Holy shit!
Yeah,
this guy is fucking unbelievable."
Yeah.
So it wasn't much of a stretch.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of great guitar players out there. Just there's a lot of guitar players. A lot of a young kid, phenomenal player that you probably have not even heard of. I mean, Joe Bonamassa is one of my favorite guitar players.
Sure.
Guy is awesome.
Yeah.
But that being said, as good as everybody is, there are no more Jimi Hendrixes, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I mean, Hendrix was just so innovative. And especially in the studio. Nobody's really emulated or, I mean, he's been copied a lot.
Yes.
Style.
Yeah, but nobody.
His tone, but there are no more Hendrixes.
Yeah, they like what? I don't even know if there's anything left to get. You know, he went from a certain level to he created so much of an advance. I don't even know if there's that much room left in any way to create that kind of an advance.
Wow. Maybe not.
It's funny when you said too that I walked into the club and Jimi Hendrix is just sitting down alone. Do you think that would happen today? That somebody like would be sitting, you know, the way. What you talked about, you know, the celebrity, the furor, you know, I don't watch TV, but my wife watches like reality shows sometimes. And I look at that and it fucking blows my mind that these people are, you know, sort of like glorified. And I'm like, oh my God. I mean, I just feel like I'm an outcast because I don't get it, you know?
Well, yeah, I don't get it either.
it's but, just really weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
You also,
yeah, well, you know, Kardashians, for God's sake.
Well, yeah, I mean all that shit, you know, the housewives of X, fill in the blank. I'm like, you played on Beggar's Banquet, the Stones album, Sympathy for the Devil on it, and I was curious what it was like playing with Keith and Brian, or if Brian was even, you know.
Brian was, it was me, but the track was basically laid down with Keith on acoustic and Charlie had a little briefcase drum kit, which was just a little tiny snare drum inside a briefcase. And then it was me and Brian on these big Moroccan drums that are the kick drums. So the drums on that are made up of three, four people playing. And that's how we they laid down the basic track for street for that song. And then I played the an Indian instrument called a shenai on that very end play out, that tag on it, that horn that's on the end there.
Yeah,
that's me on there blowing this Indian thing. It's, so
yeah, it's, it kind of so, sounds like one of those like kids' birthday things.
It's an Indian instrument called a shenai.
What was it like recording with Keith, or what was that experience like, or you know, had you worked with him before, or?
Well, it just sort of, you know, we all recorded. We were all in Olympic Studios.
Okay.
We all cut there. Hendrix, Stones, Traffic, and Jimmy Miller, who was brought over to produce Traffic by Chris Blackwell, was producing, and Eddie Kramer, who was the engineer for Hendrix, Traffic, Stones. It's hard to explain what being in London in the 60s was like. It was like nothing I've ever been around since. I mean, it was just a great time. And a lot of interaction, very easy to meet people, very easy to run into people. You know, it was a unique time.
Were people real accommodating with like Nashville's kind of an odd animal, and like there's a lot of musicians there and they're pretty supportive of one another, even though in a sense they're competing for the same gigs. Was it like that in London where you guys were all supportive, or was it really competitive?
It was competitive, of course, you know, but you know, it was not unusual to drop by somebody's session and you know, while they're setting up or something, say, hey, they go, you got anything new we can hear? And you go, yeah, actually I do. I got a tape with me. You want to hear what we're working on? So, you know, it was interesting. And I was just learning, you know. And so for me, being around people like Hendrix and the Stones and all that stuff, you know, if you're going to, I don't know. If you're gonna be doing something, then if you're gonna learn about it, you may as well put yourself around the best.
Oh yeah, that was a great God. That's pretty. You can't get any better than that group. All you guys.
Right.
I want to talk about some of my favorite songs on Alone Together. And this is so funny. I mean, I wore the grooves out of this thing when I first got it. It was really different. It was really cool. You got some long songs on there, which I'm a big fan of that. Shouldn't Have Took More Than You Gave. I love the wah on it. The solo's great. And there's a lot of guitar players listening to this. So I was curious if any chance, well, now that I've heard your memory, there probably is a really good chance. Do you remember which wah pedal you were using on that, and or what guitar playing you were playing on the track, the electric?
Yeah, the wah pedal is the same as I've always used, Crybaby.
Ah.
And the solo is a Gretsch Country Gentleman.
Oh, interesting. Was that a guitar you played a lot?
No. I used it on that because I liked the tone of it. I liked it worked for that song. I mean, I'll play different guitars for different songs. It just depends on the tone for me.
That's really interesting. Sad and Deep as You, man, that is, it's a beautiful ballad. I love that. I was curious a couple of things. Number one, what's the song about, and maybe what's the backstory? And
they're all love songs, man.
They're all love songs.
They're all love songs. Even the hate songs are love songs.
Have you ever heard Government Mule do that? They do it quite often in their routine.
Yeah, Warren. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite Mule songs, as a matter of fact. And then, of course, Look at You, Look at Me. You added a piano and what sounds like a B3 to that. And I was curious, you know, what prompts your decision to do stuff like that? If that's even a legitimate question, I'm always just fascinated by that, the creative process.
Well, it needed some keyboard after we cut the basic track. So I can't remember who played organ on. It's probably Larry Nechtel played on World in Changes. But Leon's playing piano on that and shouldn't have took more than he gave.
On Leon Russell?
Yeah.
That's really cool. I do you know any of his... Well, this is much later. I've spoken with a number of his guitars, but this is later in his life. That song is 7.5 minutes long. Was it designed that way when you first started, or is that just how it unfolded as you guys worked it out?
Well, no. When I go in a studio, I know what the songs. I have the song written. It's done. Then my way of dealing with it is just then I open it up to here's the song, guys. Let me hear what you're going to put to it. So I always kind of leave enough room for the other musicians to put what they feel into it so that it's not so structured. I mean, it's structured, but I loosely structure it. And I mean, the whole thing with Alone Together for me was the basic concept was just to put an album together that was basically acoustic and electric guitar together. So that was the concept basically behind it. But that usually when I'm, like I said, when I'm doing a song, I usually leave it. It's loosely constructed. It's constructed, but it's loosely constructed because I like to give the other musicians. I like them to feel like they're putting their own. I want to hear what they come up with. They might come up with something that's like, "Whoa, man, that's cool." You know, that just, you know.
So you're not you're not a control freak in the studio.
To an extent. But it's not like I'm putting a sheet music in front of them and going, here, play this.
Sure.
There is no sheet music. It's, guys, I want you to play what you feel. I mean, I can't read or write music. I wouldn't know where the hell to start. Sure. So,
do you talk about a great guitar solo, that whole outro, you know, the fills, the solo, it's just awesome. Do you remember what guitar you were playing there?
It's a Flying V.
Wow, that's not what I expected. Holy shit. That's really cool. Do you still have these guitars?
No. Well, no, they all got stolen out of Record Plant when I was cutting the album.
Oh, shit. That sucks. In your bio on your website, it says you were once quoted as saying, "Living is definitely not for the weak or faint of heart," which I...
Oh, by the way, let me step back a minute.
Yep.
We're talking about Alone Together and Look at You, Look at Me. Just to clear something up for everybody out there. If you go on Wikipedia, which I hate because a lot of bullshit in there, is... There's because anybody can get in there,
right?
So there's, I haven't looked recently, but I know that there's somebody's put in there a list of players. Some of them I have never even heard of, and the fact that it's Eric Clapton playing the solo on "Look at You, Look at Me." So I'd like to just clear that up and just say Eric Clapton is not even on Alone Together doing anything. So.
Yeah. You know, that's why when I always talk to people, I try to get some information directly from them for that specific reason, because I know there's a lot of shit out there and there's no barrier to entry. So anybody can post a web, you know, say whatever they want. So in your case, you had stuff on your website, so it was cool. But yeah, I never, ever rely on, quote, the internet.
Right.
In your bio, it says that you were once quoted as saying, "Living is definitely not for the weak or faint of heart." And I agree with that 100%. It's true, man. You're going to, you know, life is tough. You're going to get scathed. It's just to what degree and what's your coping skills to take it,
right,
and bounce back.
Right.
I was curious since you had said that, what are some of the things that have helped you get over or get through hard times, you know, or the coping skills, or the, you know, how do you deal with the bullshit basically, you know, or the stress you had? Is there anything in particular?
I just have a strong belief in myself. I was just brought up that way.
Thanks. What do you do when that's challenged? I'm asking for personal reasons because I always need more tools, you know, because that's always challenged.
But, you know, it's like the old quote, you know, this too shall pass.
Yeah, man.
So, you know, it's just, and it's like problems are either, you know, if it's a real problem, it can be solved. If it's not, it's either a lie or it's bullshit.
Mm. Yeah. No, I hear you, man. You just suck it up and to grin and bear it.
Yeah. You know, you just cowboy up, baby.
Yep. Yep.
and the thing is, those are the things you learn from. You don't learn from your successes.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, that is 100% correct. Yeah. You get burned and then you learn the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. If you could go back, is there anything, any advice you'd give to young Dave Mason that if you had had it at the time, or you'd wish you would have had it at the time?
Don't trust people so much.
At times you were too trusting?
Totally. Always.
Was this both here and in the UK?
Yeah. Pay more attention to business too.
Yeah.
And get some people around you to tell you when, you know, will tell you you're full of shit. Don't make sure you don't get a lot, you know, make sure you're not surrounded by just yes people.
Do you think a lot of that plays into your initial early comment about the celebrity factor that, like, for some reason that seems to attract that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like, it's like the, you know, it's like, you know, I don't read reviews and I don't really read press stuff.
Mm.
You know, don't believe what you, I just don't. So.
No, I can understand that. Yeah. Because you're reading something and really it's just an opinion.
Exactly. It's just an opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about gear and guitars for a few minutes. Has your taste in guitars changed over the years? Like, were you the guitars you went to, your go-to guitars as a younger player, are they similar or different to what your go-to guitars are now?
No, I play a custom Strat.
Fender?
Yeah.
And when you were younger, you didn't play Fenders?
Oh yeah, that was the guitar. That's what I always wanted. It was a Stratocaster.
Oh, okay. So,
probably one of the greatest designs ever. It's a beautiful piece of art. That it'll still look great 1,000 years from now, the Strat. And you know it's great because so many guitar companies have copied it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I've interviewed a couple of guys that own boutique guitar companies, and there's literally hundreds of them now, as you probably know, right. And they have all told me pretty much that unless you have a design that replicates a Les Paul or a Strat, man, it's, you know, people are reluctant to buy something else. You got a long road.
Yeah.
So is that, what else do you play besides a custom Strat now?
That's what I play on stage. I have a custom setup telly that I use sometimes. And then in the studio, I don't know. I'll use a Les Paul. I'll use a Strat. I'll use a Telecaster. I'll use a, I don't know. It depends on what the song is.
Sure. Do you have any cool or interesting stories behind how you acquired any of your guitars?
Not really. No. No, I don't. There's no unusual ways that I've acquired them.
Any players who have influenced your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
Yeah, Hank Marvin.
Oh.
Hero.
Very cool.
He was my hero when I started. I wanted to be Hank Marvin.
I bet you a lot of kids growing up in England wanted to be Hank Marvin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Has your playing changed at all over the last 5 to 10 years?
It's gotten better.
In what way?
Just gotten better. It's gotten... I'm not very dexterous on it. I'm not going to play, I'm not going to play, 20 notes when I could play three.
Sure.
It's just gotten more. It's just gotten better for me.
Do you work? Do you still practice?
No.
See, maybe that's the key. I stopped practicing and I got better.
Well, I've never really practiced. It's just weird. I just sort of, I'll sit and, took 3 months off for the first time in 16 years.
Yeah. Oh, you're not touring now. You're not in Maui touring. You're just literally chilling out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome, man. Good for you. So how are you having a hard time relaxing?
No, I can do nothing really easily.
That's really cool. Wow, so, I wish I could do nothing really easy, man. Oh, I'm serious.
But it's the first time it's been about 16 years since I took a break like this.
Good for you.
But I pick my guitar up. I've got my Strat here, my little custom Champ amp, and so I'll play around with just mostly to keep some calluses on my fingers.
Sure. Sure. That's good, man. I'm glad you're enjoying yourself.
Yeah.
If I had to ask you to pick your top three albums, not no particular order, just for today, knowing that tomorrow that might change, what would you pick today?
They've always been my three favorite albums that I think everybody should have in their collection is James Brown at the Apollo, B.B. King Live at the Regal, and Ray Charles live at the Newport Jazz Festival.
Very cool, man. I don't know that one live at the Newport Jazz Festival. I'm going to have to check that one out. Dave, what's something that you've learned about you along this whole journey you've been on?
Patience.
So it's a marathon, not a sprint?
Yeah.
Are you naturally a patient guy, or did you have to become patient?
You learn it. I mean, being on the road I've been on the road since I was playing. I mean, I've been playing live since I was 17 years old, 16, 17. Wow. And I'll be 72 this May. So,
Wow, 55 years on the road. Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you have to be patient.
And flexible.
Yeah, it's interesting because, people think the viewpoint of the public with musicians is just a glamorous life. But, 100% of the musicians I've talked to said, yeah, it's glamorous for an hour and a half.
Yeah, that's so I tell him, it's like, hey, you know what? It's like, it looks so great. I know. I said, yeah, you know what? Why don't you come on the road with me for a month and then you tell me what it's like, okay?
Yeah. Yeah. And when I sometimes in the beginning when I started this podcast, I'd interview people and they'd be out of town on the road. And I'd say, hey, listen, I really appreciate your time when you're out on the road. And they say, no, you don't get it. You've just helped me pass an hour and 15 minutes of my life away that I would have been sitting here, jerking myself off playing video games or something like that.
Yeah.
So I get
it. I could tell everybody, it's just, I'm not getting paid to stand up there and play music. I'm getting paid to leave the house.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting paid for.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your best childhood memory?
Oh, God. I suppose going home after the hospital.
After you injured yourself when you were a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I was in this hospital for a year and a half.
Holy crap. Wow. I saw that on your bio. I didn't get that. You were in the hospital a year and a half.
Yeah.
Wow. Holy shit. That is amazing.
Yeah. So probably that's the best one.
Yeah. That's like real easy to believe. Wow. Holy shit. What impact did that accident have on you over the long term, if any?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know.
No, it's all good, man.
I don't know.
So maybe you're what? Go ahead. Sorry.
It'd be hard to define, I suppose. I don't know.
Tell me, and sometimes the wife needs to answer this question. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
See, we're guys. We think everything we do is normal.
Well, I'm pretty, you know, I'm just really basic guy. I mean, when I'm not working, I consider myself pretty boring, frankly. I don't know. I don't really have any unusual I just thought about, was thinking about that, but it's not about myself. For me, it would be, if I just think about it, would be not getting into the Royal Air Force, which is really what I wanted to do.
So if you had gotten into the RAF, you might not be here right now. I mean, talking to me. I mean,
yeah, no, I would.
Wow, that's interesting.
Which is really, really what I wanted to do when I was 14, 15, 16.
Do you have any regrets that you didn't get in there?
No. I spent enough time in the past flying. So I got that sort of out of my system.
And then some, I would imagine. What's the most important thing your mom and dad taught you?
For my father, is self-reliance and keep your word. From my mother, anything's possible.
That's a great lesson. Do you have a non-musical superpower, Dave?
Perseverance.
Are you a stubborn guy?
I'm a Taurus.
I guess so. Yeah, well,
I'm slow and plodding, but I'll get there.
Yeah. Well, you know, the tortoise won the race, not the hare, right?
Yeah, right.
you mentioned your wife. How long have you been married?
We've been together 15 years.
Good for you, man. Congratulations. That's a long time. Is your wife from the UK also?
Yeah, she's from Dallas, Texas.
I'll tell you a funny story. My wife is from the UK, and she was telling me a story when she was younger and she first came to America. It's before we met. And she said some guy was hitting on her in the bar. She couldn't stand the guy, and he comes over and goes, "Hey, I love your accent. Where are you from?" And she just looks at him and says, "Dallas, Texas." So that reminded me of when you said that. You've lost a lot of your accent, you know.
That's what everybody keeps saying.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have to I was just brought up to speak the Queen's English. Okay. To be understood.
Yeah.
And the other part about it is, as I remind everybody, not everybody sounds like the gecko from England. Okay.
Very true. No, I mean, I hear it in certain words, but
there are a lot of accents over there, but I've been here since 1969. So.
Okay. Yeah. So it's filtered down a little bit.
It's sort of filtered. Yeah.
Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music, Dave?
No, like I said, I'm a pretty boring guy. I just reading mostly.
What kind of stuff you like to read?
Like biographies.
Oh, cool.
A lot. History. And then I'm a and Patterson.
Nonfiction.
Nonfiction stuff. Yeah. So I read a lot.
You may have answered this already when you said don't be so trusting, but if you can go back in time and do one thing differently, either in business or personal, is there anything you would have done differently?
Well, mostly I'd say pay attention to your business.
I think that's
very cavalier when I was younger. You know, when you're younger anyway, you just think it's just going to go on forever.
But I think that's not an uncommon thing in the music business, though, from everybody I speak to.
Nope.
Yeah. Who's had the biggest influence on you throughout your life? Is there any one particular person?
For my life, it would have to be my mother and my father.
And one last question, man, and you've been just, or two questions. First, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, do you think?
Playing better with others.
Man, that's a good lesson to learn. That's a good feeling, no?
Yeah.
That's good, man. I'm happy for you.
I'm sure the other people are too.
Yeah, I bet. Oh, I can tell you they are, man. Hey, you do some charitable work. Is there any, you want to talk about any of your charitable work that you do or any of the organizations you work with?
Well, I saw one of your questions. What are you most proud of?
Yeah.
That's what I'm the most proud of anything I've ever done. That's what I'm proudest of is my friend and I, Teddy Knapp, have a little charity called Rock Our Vets. And we support primarily vets, but we support all uniformed organizations, law enforcement, firemen. And we have a 501c3 charity, which is we're an all volunteer charity. Mm-hmm. So whatever we take in goes where it's supposed to go, not just a small percentage like most charities. Mm. That's what I'm most proud of.
And where can help?
You can go to davemasonmusic.com and there should be a link to Rock Our Vets. Because I can't remember whether it's rockourvets.org or .net. I don't know which one. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. But to know that I've kind of helped somebody with something. And it's not just money we look for, because that's not what – they need all kinds of things. I mean, you know, if you've got an old computer, give it to us. We'll get the whole thing cleaned up and give it to a vet, or clothes, or car, or – things.
Man, I didn't know about this. This is great. It's rockourvets.org, everybody. This is really cool because like I didn't know that. I'd love to, because I'm really empathetic to veterans, man. I mean, I know so many guys that came back and yeah, some of them are pretty fucked up from the experience they had.
Well, it's personally to me, I think it's a national disgrace the way they're treated.
Yeah.
And I don't care what your political party is or what you think, but the way they're treated is just, it's morally corrupt. It's just not right.
Yeah. Well, I really like this. Thanks. And you guys are doing something down here, actually, Southwest Florida, second annual comedy night.
Yeah.
Do you remember that show you played in Clearwater 2 years ago?
Not specifically.
I'll tell you, man, it was a really, you know what? It was really nice. It was like a retrospective, and I really liked the stories. Like, you told stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, in between the songs. I thought it was really cool. It was interesting. And, I, of course, taking my son there, it's always meaningful when I share music with my son, but especially music I grew up with, you know, it means that much more. I don't know if you have kids or anything, but it's you know, rewarding for me to do that with him. But
yeah.
It was a real nice show, and I appreciate you know, you putting that on, and I'm glad I got to go, and I appreciate this. Where can people, so people could find you online at Dave Mason Music. What do you have anything new going on there that you'd like to promote or that you want to let people know about, or something new upcoming, and how can I get people to send you money?
Yeah. Well, actually, Rock Our Vets, you can just you know, click on the link and go to the website, and it's in there. How you can, if you want to donate money, you can do that through the website, or if you want to donate something else, you just contact my dear friend Ted Knapp. But what I'm real excited about is later in the year, we're going out putting together the feeling all right rock and soul review. And it's going to be me and Steve Cropper.
Wow. Holy shit. That's some good guitar playing there between you two guys.
Well, it's like you saying, you know, who'd have thought you'd be interviewing me, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, Booker T and the MGs, who played on so many fucking records, it's ridiculous. I mean, that was the shit we were listening to when we were kids. Like, God, man, that feels, and that band is so cool. So for me to be playing with, you know, doing something like this with Cropper is just I don't know how personally, individually well known he is out there to the public. To music people, it would be, but it's cool. It'll be fun.
It's called The Feeling All Right Rock and Soul Review.
Yep.
Where can people find information about that?
Well, we're in the formative stages of it. Hopefully we'll be out on the road there. Hopefully this summer.
That's awesome, man. You coming down here again?
I'm sure we will.
That's great, man. How'd you hook up with Steve?
With Cropper?
Yeah.
Through a friend of mine who works with him, and we got to, and I've met him in the past, but it was last year down in Nashville. We got together and had dinner, and then hopefully we're hoping that we're hoping that Michael McDonald's going to come join us too.
That's great. What a show that'll be, man.
Oh yeah. That'd be one hit after another.
Yeah. that's not a bad show to see. You won't be lacking to know the songs on that show, no matter where you grew up.
Right.
Well, hey man, is there anything else that you want to make people aware of that you're doing or you're involved with?
No, we pretty much covered it.
Well, listen, I cannot hang on. I want to say goodbye to the audience, and I'll wrap up with you after that. But I can't thank you enough for your time, man. It's really cool of you to spend time, especially on your vacation. I really appreciate you being so straightforward, answering all the questions and sharing all these stories. It was really interesting.
No problem.
Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Again, many, many thanks to Dave Mason for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. Go check out DaveMasonMusic.com and pay attention and look for Dave and Steve Cropper coming up soon on the Feeling All Right Rock and Soul Review. I saw Dave in concert 2 years ago. It's a fantastic show. You certainly will not be disappointed. And that's it. Thank you for listening. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified of future episodes, along with some cool stuff we're rolling out. And be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Until next time, peace and love. I'm out. And thanks again, Dave Mason. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.